Several months ago, I made up my mind that I was going to skip from Romans 1:18 to the third chapter and leave out all in between. The wrath of God and His condemnation. But I figured I came here preaching a message of grace and faith, and everybody else throughout most of my life growing up in the church concentrated on long and detailed descriptions of sin, for which you were all going to go to hell. In a hurry, if you didn't stop. I figure this congregation knows more about sin than most of the preachers that preach. Most of you had left the institutional churches. And that gets less and less as I've essentially raised a generation within this church, now in my 26th year. But God wouldn't let me do what I thought I would do, is skip over what I was sure you already knew and get on to the wondrous message of God's grace for those in sin. But God wouldn't let me do it. We have camped out, and you have again the same handout in front of you to take notes on for today. We've camped out on these passages that on the handout include a little insert of the King James Version running from the 19th verse to the beginning of the 24th. The wrath of God is presently being revealed. That's where this started. After the grace of God and the righteousness of God is briefly unfolded in those first 17 verses. And the wondrous gospel, good news, that for faith, for trusting Him, God covers all of our sins, puts them on His Son. We walk out from underneath them, and the curse deserved because of our sin, into a new life relationship where He does the righteousing in us as long as we trust Him. And thus Christianity becomes an ever-increasing walk from faith to faith, because faith keeps the connection. Then God says, at the same time, the wrath of God is being revealed. Now this was written 2,000 years ago. The wrath of God is being revealed. The slow buildup of God's wrath, orgy, not themis, which is a fiery, breathing fire from the nostrils kind of picture, but like a slow, festering boil. Now, not tomorrow, now is being revealed the wrath of God. And the way in which it is being revealed is a reaction to a failure to recognize His presence. If your only revelation is the creation itself, failure to see it cannot be without a mighty hand of design. Recognition of the Creator, His existence and power, and thanksgiving and worship to a God who did all of this, provided all of this, and instead ruled Him out. You know, God can get real You know, it's just hard to find a word. I've got asteroid orifice and bovine scatology, but I got to work on PO'd. It's just really hard. That's why the Australian sailors use that word for about everything. It just got such rich meaning. You ever been PO'd? And this is not the post office, though they PO you once in a while. God's PO. He rubbed raw on this. He creates a garden, creates a world, and turns it all over to Adam and Eve. And to force recognition of his absolute power and sovereignty, his right, he gave it all to them. But at least respect his ultimate power, which includes his right to say, no, don't touch this tree. They wanted the garden without him. And to not see God's hand, get in God's frame of reference on his page, even though this is reviewed and we've covered it many times, from his perspective, he's left enough imprint to at least have his presence respected and recognized and worship and thanksgiving is his due. And he comes collecting as the gospel age opens. It's collection day as well as resurrection day. He comes collecting. His wrath now is being revealed. He will not continue to tolerate being ruled out of the garden of life and the universe by people whose brains he gave them in the first place. The ultimate Frankenstein story, the creation turning on the Creator. Now that's what this series of messages is about. That God's wrath, slow building up boil, has broken. And his wrath is now being released, and a level of eternal tolerance has been maxed out. And he's upset as hell over being ignored, much less being denied. And the wrath that's now being revealed is to withdraw a sense capacity, a sight capacity, an insight capacity to ever see his hand. It's to be made blind, to be made God blind, to have sight removed, to where you're wandering around still thinking you have capacities that you once had and didn't recognize you had. It's gone. You've been mentally gilded. You understand that? You've been mentally gilded. And made spiritually impotent. Maybe I can find phrases that will drive this home. You can't do it anymore. And God will not prescribe a spiritual Viagra. Got it? You ain't got it anymore when God withdraws this capacity. 12,000 angels could materialize in front of you. And you'd find another explanation when this happens to you. It is a perverse and evil state of anti-godness that produces what the King James called vain. I've already covered that word. Circle it. Circle the word vain. And write Matthias, which is the Greek word. It's an evil, motivated, self-deceived, self-aggrandizing, self-motivated, self-preserving state of mind. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, because He's there to be knowable, even in law. In law, we have a distinction between actual knowledge and constructive knowledge. You know that you can be held accountable for constructive knowledge. That which was there to be known, could have been known, should have been known if you paid attention, and therefore you're responsible for not knowing it. Well, I didn't know it. Sorry. You had constructive knowledge. I didn't know that there was some cloud on this title. It was recorded in a deed at the county recorder's office, available for anybody that checked and did their homework. Therefore, you had constructive knowledge because you could have got it if you'd have done your job. You understand that? It's what God's saying. There's constructive knowledge of His presence. And because He, when they knew that God was there, they glorified Him not as God, nor were thankful, but became vain, matthias, self-serving, self-interested. What else did He do? What was the motivation that He gave her? You'll be like God. Everybody wants to be God. They don't want to worship God. Neither were thankful, but came vain, matthias in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. And you remember I handed out the Greek. Their senseless heart became dark. And the word was taking away what from the Old Testament to the New was a faculty God-given. No man cometh to the Father save the Spirit growing. Mysterious passages like deep calleth unto deep have relevance here. God puts sight to see light. That faculty to see God is gone and they become sense, without sense, taken away, and their heart becomes darkened to the light of God. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of, and that's the Greek you have in front of you, the glory of an incorruptible God, and I have it on the board. An incorruptible, aphartu, theou, into a likeness of an image, homoi omati, or homoi omati, iconos, from which we get icon. They changed the eternal God who created all of this. They changed it. The eternal God, non-dying, non-decaying, non-disappearing, non-empty. They changed the God who is none of these decaying and passing away things into a likeness of an icon that decays. And we spent last Sunday in particular, raising the question, well, now, icons, that's things that heathens do. They carve out images and worship the images. No. They make likenesses of that which they really worship, which in the case of these professing to be wise but becoming morons, in the case of these who have had God's sense withdrawn, in the case of these who no longer have the capacity to see God, they do empty self-serving dialogues and create with words, as God created everything with His Word, they create with words new images, likeness of icons that they offer in the place of the Creator, and will be condemned in subsequent verses as worshiping the creation and the creature rather than God, and producing icons. And to those that haven't been listening the last few weeks, icons of evolution. And they're there. This book punches holes in 10 of them. Icons that become the worshipful, respectful basis for a naturalistic explanation of the world that rules out God. Now, I decided today, I meant to go on, but I'm gripped again and forced by God to stay here and deal with the deliberateness of these men, the focus on removing God from the equation, the maliciousness and the deceitfulness to prove that it's Matthias, self-deceiving, self-aggrandizing, self-perpetuating, projections of their own mind in words of their description that we are expected to bow before instead of the creature, instead of the Creator that created we miserable sinning creatures. You know, Darwinism is a fraud, and yet it rules the world today. And I'm returning to it to be even more abusive in exposing the fraudulent bases and the evil anti-God attack mode that it springs from. Christians have been too long on the defensive, and what's worse, we've been allowed to be marginalized until someone can disdainfully say, it's not worth responding to because it's not even, doesn't even deserve the credibility of being false. You understand how subtle that satirical slam is? It's fantasy land. Christianity is for idiots or those that for some emotional reason park brains at the entrance of the church, because everybody knows, and there's no greater dogmatism than the phrase everybody knows, that Darwinism and evolution is a fact, and that's how we got here. Well, let's trace some of this nonsense. You know where the phrase agnostic entered the English language? Huxley. Huxley, the disciple, bitter disciple of Christianity. To give you some of his state of mind, I'm going to take the time today to find these and read some things, because I'm moving toward leaving the subject. Shattering the Myths of Darwinism by Richard Milton. Page 259. By the way, he's not a creationist. Don't even think he's a Christian. He's a science editor, a member of Mensa, the High IQ Society, respected science editor. Direct conflict and confrontation with religious belief was built into Darwinism from the outset. Now, I don't know why God's keeping me on this. And I know that the audience and the congregation that's grown up under my teaching these past 26 years, they're not impressed with Darwinism, but your kids are going to be absorbed in this. If you have a family, there's no escaping the frame of reference. It has taken over the universities and the academic world. We are indeed in the tunnel that Houston Smith described. And the worship of the scientific method, which is scientism or naturalism, that goes beyond science. Science, I have no quarrel with. Science that deals with sensory experience and testable items, I have no trouble with that. But it's become the current religion until the high priests of the religious establishment of today's world are scientists. And the educational system is based upon the premises of naturalism, and the judges that interpret the laws are educated in those universities, and the lawmakers who make the laws, most of whom are lawyers, are educated in those same universities, and the media talking heads, the few that have some education, are educated in those same universities. And there is an established religion in the world today of naturalism, period. Scientism and naturalism as the metaphysics of reality. But direct conflict and confrontation with religious belief was built into Darwinism from the outset. Darwin expected trouble. And he had a Christian wife. So you can understand, the food might be cold when he got home. And being a retiring sort, he didn't relish the prospect. But his great champion, Thomas Huxley, certainly did savor the cut and thrust of scientific debate. And after urging Darwin to make his findings public, Huxley confided to Darwin on the eve of publication that he was sharpening up my claws and beak in readiness. I'll read some quotes by Huxley. But he tried to avoid his anti-religious stance by introducing into the wide usage of the English language the word agnostic. And suddenly, agnosticism. You know why and where he chose that word to avoid the public verbal scourging that would come in a world that was pretty much dominated by the natural theology of the day and theism, and if not theism, deism, and some kind of role of God in the reality of things. So to avoid being dubbed atheist, he called himself an agnostic. He picked it up from Acts 17:23. The Greek words agnosto, theo, where Paul on Mars Hill says, looking at all their images and icons, says, I see you have an altar here to the agnosto theo, the unknown or not known God. Now, I want you to see the threads, because here is a man without excuse, who names himself as a result of studying Paul. Without excuse, lest God seem overly harsh in his condemnation of these people, when he's going to have his wrath on simple heathen who can't recognize his footprints in creation, if you're entertaining any harsh thoughts toward God for his harsh treatment of these people from whom he withdraws sense, remember, as I told you, Stephen Hawking, at 13, with two of his friends, turned his back while the two friends converted in a Billy Graham crusade, and his wife, last I heard, and recent, don't know for sure, but last I heard and recent, separated over his atheistic views. And what's worse is sort of patronizing inclusion of God in a quasi-comedic way in his speeches. Married to a vitally committed evangelical Christian woman, sharing research through the years with another scientist deeply committed to God as a partner in research. This is not someone that didn't have a chance. This is someone who said he always has felt if he can understand something, he'll be the master of it. And that tells you where he's coming from. As I've told you, R.C. Sproul says atheism is a state of mind that doesn't want a master. Just that simple. All of these people have a passion beyond the normal against God. Now, let me bore you by illustrating. Am I boring you already?
No, sir.
Oh, it's over here. First book I picked up. Okay. There is a ruling priesthood in America today, and one of the best writers around is the professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, talking about holding forth in an alien society. But he has written some wonderful books, Reason and the Balance, and prior to that, Darwin on Trial. Listen to this. In our own day, the ruling priesthood consists of authoritative bodies like the National Academy of Sciences, the academic and legal elites, and the managers of the national media. The new priesthood, like the old ones, has a vested interest in safeguarding its cultural authority by making it as difficult as possible for critics to be heard. Boy, they gnash their teeth because I'm heard all around the world. Maybe you will understand the importance of your participation because, as I said, I don't really think that the members of this church that have been raised under this teaching are in danger of being led astray by these doctrines. But there's a world out there, and I have said many times, the mystery of God raising my voice and making it the only voice, single voice, the only single voice that is a single voice heard 24 hours a day around the world, is because it's the only voice that hasn't got some kind of bondage that can silence. I can do as Paul did, say, henceforth let no man trouble me. I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus without compromise. without some presbyter board down in the South that's decreed you can't drink Mountain Dew because it creates an appetite for beer? Do you think any other voice in the world could have you dancing the aisles here as we did this morning on Father's Day? Do you think anybody... I don't need any academic appointments. They gnash their teeth out there and probably wish that they'd caught me before I got a PhD from Stanford. Because the credential just grinds in their face. It wasn't an honorary degree. I earned it in philosophies of education. There is no one out there in academic circles, in fact, probably listen to me occasionally, are presidents of universities that did their doctorate with me at Stanford under Professor Cowley or under Larry Thomas. I was always the odd one. I believed in God. There are plenty of them out there. When I went to be president of a university in the East, he said to me, "Gene, if the resurrection, when I challenged him, is true, would force me to revise my whole life, and I think the chances of it being true are so remote, I'm not going to run the risk." Well, I respected him for his stupidity. I mean, at least he had honest stupidity. He wasn't going to risk it being true. Vested interests. I'm a free voice. I can do this. The only thing that circumscribes my freedom, and that's God and my own intellectual and academic integrity. I have to be sure that what I'm telling you is true. And that's why I'm going to read some of this stuff. The new priesthood, like the old ones, has a vested interest in safeguarding its cultural authority by making it as difficult as possible for critics to be heard. The modern equivalent of excommunication is marginalization, which is much more humane than physical punishment, but just as effective in protecting the ruling philosophy. You know, they're not running anymore. They used to. I used to be one of five people invited to every major religious convention in the charismatic and Pentecostal circles. But you know, as I preached without fear or favor, they can hardly afford, because the mix has got to homogenize a little bit. And you got to somehow move a little more to the center. You can't just tell it the way it is. Except here. The modern equivalent is marginalization. Those who try to challenge naturalism are confined not to a prison cell, but in a stereotype. And the terms in which the media and the textbooks report any controversy are defined in a manner designed to prevent dangerous ideas from getting serious consideration. Whatever the critics of naturalism say is mere religious belief in opposition to scientific knowledge. Hence, it's by definition fantasy as opposed to solid fact. And that snide attitude is what I face as early as my undergraduate years, when I was reader, as I told you, for the head of the history department, Lou Oliver, and he called me in. I had the best grades in the class. I was his reader. So he had to somehow justify having someone, and my faith hadn't yet been totally pulled apart. And he said, "I can't understand the grades. I look at your grades. You're my reader. I've told you this 100 times. In other words, he could not equate academic brain and accomplishments with a belief in the supernatural. So he sat back, and I still remember, he sat back, put his hands behind his head, and put his feet up on the desk, says, I've finally figured it out. I've decided it's some vestigial emotional attachment to your father. What a put down. Now, I think now, having matriculated through all the years, and he tried that on me, he wouldn't be sitting in that chair. But as a student, I just grinned and bore it. And I'm telling the young people in this church, don't eliminate yourself from the academic program. Don't carry on a running fight with your teachers. Just go ahead and listen to their prattle and be the best student in the class. And then when you get out, find a platform like I've got to say what fools they were. Now, but I want to show you the maliciousness of this ruling priesthood. How? It's all deliberate. They have an attitude. They do not intend to make room for the Creator in any way at all. Let's take Harvard paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson. Just to give you the minds of the priesthood of the elite that are always called upon, sit on the boards that determine whether your articles will get published, are on the editorial and advisory boards of the major scientific publications, are always called upon as experts by the media, are called upon as expert witnesses in any legal decisions in this country. This is the unholy priesthood that dominates the tunnel that we've talked about. The famous Harvard paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson straightforwardly put it, quote, the meaning of evolution, that is to say the guiding premise of the branch of natural science that studies the history of life, is that, quote, man is the result of purposeless and natural processes that did not have him in mind. Douglas Fuchiyama, who is maybe the most widely used author of evolutionary biology textbooks, your kids will confront him in their textbooks in college, is just as plain spoken. Quote, this is the textbook writer that your kids will study. Some shrink from the conclusion that the human species was not designed, has no purpose, and is the product of mere mechanical mechanisms. But this seems to be the message of evolution. And as Johnson points out, if the evolutionary scientists are right, then believers in God are deluded. People who think God is real either do not understand the meaning of evolution or, for personal reasons, Lou Oliver, my vestigial psychological ties, for personal reasons, are unwilling to follow the path of scientific understanding to its logical conclusion in naturalism. That's two. I'm going to quote from the priesthood of the established religion of America, naturalism. Francis Crick, biochemist. What do you have to say? Am I boring you?
No, sir.
I'm illustrating, professing themselves to be wise, they become morons. I'm illustrating that in an age when there's much more reason to see the hand of God, you go to the farthest reaches of space, and 90% of it we can't find. So they give it a name, dark matter, and they don't even know what it is, 99%. And you analyze reality with Einstein's formulas of general and special relativity that lead, by definition, through his speculation, to an ultimate singularity of a starting point that birthed the idea of the Big Bang. And Einstein hates it, though the conclusion is required with his mathematical formula, having been applied to space and its expanding and rates, etc. You go in reverse, takes you to a singularity. And then all kinds of speculative theories start leaping out of the vain imaginations of these men, anything but God. And then Einstein, completely blown away, when he participates in an experiment called the EPR experiment, where particles separated, touch one, affects the other, faster than the speed of light, suggesting an unknown connection. And then the quantum mechanics blows his mind completely, makes him die an unproductive and unhappy man, because they go to the bottom of the micro-universe, to some primordial soup, and you encounter total uncertainty. Total uncertainty. It blows the naturalistic philosophy, as C.S. Lewis saw years ago, because the naturalism philosophy says there is a cause for everything and a natural explanation for everything, and now you get down to the building substance of reality itself, and it's unpredictable and uncertain, and you can't even locate a particle in the same place. In fact, the act of observing it changes it. So, what molecule, as a cell back there 15 billion years ago, exploding out of some Big Bang, by chance programmed itself into a fully working scientist who is going to change the matter of reality by observing it today? The point is, the further they go out and the further they go in, the more mysterious it becomes. But everything has to be naturally caused. Francis Crick, the biochemist who co-discovered the structure of DNA, almost as famous as Hawking himself in the media world. Is one of those naturalistic philosophers, eminent scientist, scientism product, who employ their own minds to attempt to prove that the mind is nothing but a product of physical forces and chemical reactions. Mind and consciousness, we can't explain it, but we will. Out goes the human soul. Out goes eternal individuality. Out goes the human spirit. Out goes the creation story. God formed Adam. Not man, issues man, Adam. Adam. Out of the dust of the earth, that's the naturalistic combination. And breathed into him. And Adam, not man, anything about whatever Ishi may be, mankind in general. Adam, the first one of unique species. Unique because formed of the elements. God breathed into him, is the biblical record. And Adam became a living soul. I read this before I go back to Francis Crick. Bears reading again. hope you can stand it. Francis Crick is going to say, there's mind and consciousness is a matter of degree, because man is nothing but a combination of chemical and molecular elements like everything else in this natural world. In short, the naturalism view is Carl Sagan, the media darling. This world, or cosmos he called it, is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. This natural world, that scientism and the basis of the tunnel we're in, that nothing exists out of this natural world, and if we can't explain it now, we ultimately will, because there is nothing that exists. We are all and everything is the product of chance, accidents, accidental mutations that produce a better surviving type, and the better survivors are defined by just one criteria, not ability to run fast, not ability to fly, not ability to swim, ability to reproduce. Those who survive reproduce the most. You understand that? That's the basis of everything that is. From the smallest elements of the universe who become, by some, mind-boggling, and the argument is it happened, therefore it ultimately can be explained by a natural process. Self-replicating cells was the first step, first life, then self-replicating, and the process is by accidental changes that improve the ability to survive and reproduce, and that's how everything from rocks to eyeballs to ants to cell structure to germs to viruses to seeds to man to elephants to worms to women. It evolved by a long period of time with almost imperceptible little accidental mutations, though mutations always, or majority of times, make you worse. They still assume occasionally one is better and creates a better survivor, and the others die off, and that's how everything came into being, this whole universe. Oh, come on. You're going to have as much incredulity as this fiction story by the writer Terry Bison that has an alien more surprised. It takes the form of a conversation between an alien. Can I read this to you again? An alien explorer who has visited Earth and his commander. The alien explorer is talking to his commander. This is by Colin McGinn, The Mysterious Flame. And he's talking about some of their prisoners they've taken here on Earth. Now I've lost my handkerchief. I must be putting my voice in the right place because I've got a runny nose. Started with my dad singing. This is a conversation between an alien explorer of Earth and his commander. They're made out of meat. The explorer says to his commander, meat? There's no doubt about it. We picked several from different parts of the planet, took them aboard our recon vessels, probed them all the way through. They're completely meat. Commander, that's impossible. What about the radio signals, the messages to the stars? They use radio waves to talk, but the signals didn't come from them. The signals come from machines. Well, so who made the machines? That's who we want to contact. They made the machines. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Meat made the machines.
That's ridiculous.
How can meat make a machine? You're asking me to believe in sentient or thinking meat? I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. These creatures are the only sentient race in the sector, and they're made all out of meat. Well, maybe they're like the Orphali. You know, a carbon-based intelligence that goes through a meat stage. Nope. They're born meat and they die meat. We studied them for several of their lifespans, which didn't take too long. Do you have any idea of the lifespan of meat? Spare me. Okay, maybe they're only part meat, you know, like the Weddell-eye, a meathead with an electron plasma brain inside. Nope. We thought of that, since they do have meatheads like the Weddell-eye. But I told you, we probed them. They're meat all the way through. No brain? Oh, there's a brain all right. It's just that the brain's made out of meat. So what does the thinking? You're not understanding, are you? The brain does the thinking, the meat. Thinking meat? You're asking me to believe in thinking meat? Yes. Thinking meat, conscious meat, loving meat, dreaming meat, the meat's the whole deal. Are you getting the picture? This whole book is about the mysterious plane, that impossible gulf that all the efforts of modern science has still not bridged between the brain and consciousness. How that same pile of meat at death, something left it. But a unique kind of consciousness that has a God module to it, that sees and thinks about God and worships until it's taken away and you become a worshiper of the creation. You'd think the evidence would convince this person. He says on page 84, the writer of this brilliant study of the mysterious flame of consciousness and life that we've not yet bridged from the sentient substratum. Perhaps it would be best at this point if I lay my cards on the table, the author says. I do not believe in the supernatural in any form. But I have to admit that the argument from sentience cannot be dismissed as mere confusion. I also admit that there's no theory comparable to Darwin's that can be wheeled out to provide the kind of explanation we're looking for. What then can be said to ward off the supernatural theory of the mind? Anything but that. And keep going. This guy goes on to, he obviously is well aware of Christian arguments. Francis Crick, the biochemist who co-discovered the structure of DNA, in his later years, Crick has been drawn to the problem of consciousness and expressed his thoughts in the 1994 book, The Astonishing Hypothesis. Here is how Crick states his own starting point. Now, this is getting long, so listen closely. The astonishing hypothesis is that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. The hypothesis is so alien to the ideas of most people alive today that it can be truly, or can truly be called, astonishing. Of course, if all of our reactions The astonishing hypothesis is, as he says, all of our reactions are nothing but an accumulation of chemical and natural forces that have produced that state, and that's all there is, then why would he be astonished that those same forces have produced someone being astonished at his theory? You follow that? These are brilliant men who make these fallacies that a simple logician can spot. Oh, let's go on. I know it's going to bore you. Stanford biochemist Arthur Kornberg, my old alma mater. As the famous Stanford biochemist Arthur Kornberg complained to a 1987 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, it is astonishing that otherwise intelligent and informed people, including physicians, are reluctant to believe that mind, as part of life, is matter and only matter. Meat, I would say, and only meat. You tired? Well, go ahead and lie, but you want to hear some more. Stephen Jay Gould, probably the most influential neo-Darwinist in the world today. Not the big mouth like Dawkins, but he is influential. Stephen Jay Gould. Before Darwin, we thought that a benevolent God had created us. After the acceptance of Darwinism, however, that belief became intellectually untenable. And if anybody thinks, and I'm guilty, maybe in the 26 years, the only thing I wish I could take back is that when I said, before I really got into this, if God wanted to choose to create by evolution, he could. And the perverse side of me would probably have done it that way, to make it look like something it's not. But I've always said, it has nothing to do with the creating of Adam, that if the evolutionary pattern is correct, it wouldn't bother my faith in God. Now I'm here telling you, after much research, it's a bunch of bovine scatology. It's based on fraud and lies for the most part. Before Darwin, we thought that a benevolent God had created us. After the acceptance of Darwinism, however, that belief became intellectually untenable. According to Gould, and go ask any science teacher anywhere, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins are the two most eloquent and sought-after spokespeople for modern Darwinist views. According to Gould, no intervening spirit watches lovingly over the affairs of nature. Though Newton's clock-winding God might have set up the machinery at the beginning of time and then let it run, no vital force propel evolutionary change. And whatever we think of God, his existence is not manifest in the products of nature. If you were God, would you be mad? Well, now, let's go to Richard Dawkins. Change books for a second to get Dawkins. Darwin on trial. Oxford zoologist, one of the most influential figures in evolutionary science, wrote the 1986 book, The Blind Watchmaker, in response to Paley's famous illustration that if you walked along a mountain or a desert path and kicked a stone, it wouldn't be something to marvel at, but if you kicked something and it was a fully functioning watch, you would begin to think some intelligent design is apparent here. And the watchmaker is necessary to the watch. Dawkins took that on head on. Talks about the blind watchmaker. But at a more fundamental level, Dawkins says, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. And when he contemplates the perfidy of those who refuse to believe evolution, Dawkins can scarcely restrain his fury. Quote, "It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that." Say that to my face, Mr. Dawkins, if you are listening, and tell me which corner you want to meet on. Dawkins went on to explain, by the way, that what he dislikes particularly about creationists is that they're intolerant. All right. William Provine, Cornell University, from the same book, Darwin on Trial. Professor William Provine from Cornell University. Provine insists that the conflict between science and religion is inescapable. We'll give him credit for being honest. To the extent that persons who manage to retain religious beliefs while accepting evolutionary biology, that compromising attempt to say, I believe in God, the Creator, but also believe in evolution. Those who do that, Provine says, have to check their brains at the church house door. Because it can be done. Specifically, modern science directly implies that the world is organized strictly in accordance with mechanistic principles. There are no purposive principles whatsoever in nature. There are no gods and no designing forces that are rationally detectable. Second, modern science directly implies that there are no inherent moral or ethical laws, no absolute guiding principles for human society. Third, human beings are marvelously complex machines. The individual human becomes an ethical person by means of two primary mechanisms, hereditary and environmental influences. That's all there is. Gene, I've decided that your belief in the supernatural is a vestigial, environmental remnant, he said, psychological tie to your father's faith. An ethical person is a hereditary or environmental product. That's all there is. Fourth, we must conclude that when we die, and that's the end of us. Finally, free will, as it is traditionally conceived, the freedom to make uncoerced and unpredictable choices among alternative possible courses of action, simply does not exist. There's no way that the evolutionary process as currently conceived can produce a being that is truly free to make choices. We just don't know yet the forces that make them do what they do in the natural environment. Just what your kids are going to find as the high priest. How about evolution is the God we worship? Oh, nobody goes that far. Well, by the way, I did my doctorate, as I've told you, under the major professor was Larry Thomas, but I did cross departmental. So I worked with the New Zealand ethical theologian, Lex Miller, head of the religion department, and crossed philosophy, education, and religion. But the major professor was John Dewey's disciple, Larry Thomas, who at the time I arrived at Stanford was the president of the American Philosophy of Education Teachers Across America, and he was the recognized leading spokesperson on the West Coast for John Dewey's philosophy of experimentalism, which produced progressive education. How many of you know that John Dewey was an evangelical Christian who abandoned it and adopted Hegelian pantheism and turned from seeking absolutes to pragmatism with no absolutes of any kind? One of his followers, who went further than anybody else, was Pierre Chardin, the unorthodox Jesuit paleontologist who played an important role in the Piltdown and Peking Man discoveries. Teilhard aimed to bring Christianity up to date by founding it on the rock of evolution, rather than certain events alleged to have occurred in Palestine nearly 2,000 years ago. The more rigorously materialist Darwinists dismissed Teilhard's philosophy as pretentious, but it had a strong appeal to those of more spiritual cast of mind, those that should check their brains at the door, for example, like Dembski. And he says, evolution need no longer be a destiny imposed from without. It may conceivably be controlled by man in accordance with his wisdom and his values. Is evolution a theory, a system, or a hypothesis, he says? It's much more. It is a general postulate to which all theories, all hypotheses, all systems must henceforth bow, and which they must satisfy in order to be thinkable and true. Evolution is a light which illuminates all facts, a trajectory which all lines of thought must follow. This is what evolution is. You like that? In short, evolution is the God we must worship, which is taking us to a particular heaven, a harmonized collectivity of consciousness equivalent to a kind of superconsciousness. The earth is covering itself not only by myriads of thinking units, but by a single continuum of thought, and finally forming a functional single unit of thought of planetary dimensions. The plurality of individual thoughts combine and mutually reinforce each other in a single act of unanimous thought. In the dimensions of thought, like in the dimension of time and space, can the universe reach consummation in anything but the measureless? And as, again, I'll quote Shaq again, body, 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 body. I mean, he can dance and he can talk in tongues, apparently. His own. He gets frustrated at Kobe Bryant talking in Italian, so when the newsman turned from Kobe, who just talked in Italian, to Shaq, Shaq grabbed the mic and says, blah, 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 blah. I'm trying to illustrate professing themselves to be wise to become fools. I'm trying to illustrate that here are people that have God consciousness removed. They want to substitute the icons of their own creation. I've run out of time, but there are at least one or two more I'm going to do. If you get up and walk out, and I have to have the usher shoot you. Julian Huxley, the son of the famous Father Huxley, the high priest, now, wait a minute. I got the wrong book. That's why I can't find it. With this, though I can read you 20, 30 more, with this I'm going to bring it to a close and then close the message. The descent to pseudoscience that Darwinism descended into was completed with the triumph of the Neo-Darwinian synthesis. And at a centennial celebration of the publication of The Origin of Species in 1959 in Chicago, Darwinism was not just a theory of biology, but the most important element in a religion of scientific naturalism, with its own ethical agenda and plan for salvation through social and genetic engineering. Julian Huxley, son of the famous father that was the friend of Darwin, was the most honored speaker at Chicago, and his triumphalism was unrestrained. Future historians will perhaps take this centennial week as epitomizing an important critical period in the history of this earth of ours, the period when the process of evolution and the person of inquiring man began to be truly conscious of himself. This is one of the first public occasions on which it has been frankly faced that all aspects of reality are subject to evolution. From atoms and stars to fish and flowers, from fish and flowers to human societies and values, indeed that all reality is a single process of evolution. In the evolutionary pattern of thought, there is no longer either need or room for the supernatural. The earth was not created, it evolved. So did all the animals and plants that inhabit it, including our human selves, mind and soul, as well as brain and body. So did religion. Finally, the evolutionary vision is enabling us to discern, however incompletely, the lineaments of the new religion that we can be sure will arise to serve the needs of the coming era. In other words, God and religion are created by evolving man, and they're behind-the-scenes discussions to serve some power interest of witches and priests. And our creator is evolution, and our creator should be worshipped. And the creatures that come out of evolution become the icons of the new revolution, of the new religion. And it becomes right, therefore, to worship the creature rather than the creator. This message doesn't get people dancing in the aisle. That's why I got it out of the way early. I wanted to put a few exclamation marks on why we've been doing what we've done. If you're just listening for the first time today, then I suggest you get the tapes. We have knocked holes in the dating methods and the ancient earth. I have a belief that the earth is much longer than any 4,000 years. But the dating methods are flawed. The icons of evolution, some of them are outright frauds, and the others don't prove anything. There is no missing link. There has never been demonstrated once a change from a species to another species. And since the whole pattern of evolution is based upon capacity to reproduce, that which defines a species is it simply can't mate and produce with another. And they come up with harebrained ideas of saltation and the hopeful monsters. I said a few weeks ago that somewhere the Komodo dragon will lay an egg. And out of that egg will become Or verse 4, a newspaper reporter dumb enough to marry a woman that put him in with a dragon. That is what the scientists call hopeful monsters. Only their illustration is a lizard will lay an egg and suddenly a bird will come out of the egg and a new species is formed. The fundamental question you have to ask, since a new species has come out of this lizard egg, it can't mate with Sharon Stone anymore. You know, these are the fallacies. I'm trying to demonstrate. Brilliant men lose something. And they profess themselves to be wise and become fools. This is the way the species change. Saltation, a sudden event of a lizard lays an egg and a bird's born. Well, it got to be two birds and one's got to be of an opposite sex. Because reproduction is what keeps the new species going. I mean, this bird flapping around saying to the lizard, give me another one. That is what I'm asked to take in the place of a God who so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. A God about whom I can say, and to whom I can say, what is man that thou art mindful of him? A God who has this gospel record up to the 17th and 18th verses declares, took the step of removing any barrier between me and him, took my affirmities on him, infirmities and my sins onto himself, and simply asked me to trust him. The beginning of trust is belief, and act on that belief with the confidence that a God who formed this universe can take care of me in its place. I'm a miracle of chance. Thanks be to evolution and its wonder. I and my dad and my mother and the rest of you can thank evolution that somehow or other a bird jumped out of a lizard's egg. And this had to happen repeatedly for all the species. And I wish I could use a good King James term. These illegitimates look down on us when professing to be wise, they become morons. I'll serve a God that kept his promise to my dad. Preach my word, I'll heal you. And in his 80s, could sing like this. And that's my message, and it's offering time, and Dad's going to sing for it.